With that, I've got all the housekeeping wrapped up for today. And again, it's my good pleasure to introduce somebody that has truly been a mentor and a teacher for me. It's not actually often that I find someone that I look at their teaching and I become really enamored with their teaching. It's actually very seldom. A lot of times I'll find somebody, I'll learn a few things from them, and I'll go, okay, that's that. But it's very seldom that I find a person that every single thing they put out, I want to hear because it so resonates with me, and I always continue to learn from it, and I always feel not just educated, but entertained and engaged. And that is how I would describe Jeff Lawton. He's on my short list of not just permaculture visionaries, but absolutely outstanding, amazing teachers. I'll be honest, a lot of times I listen to a teacher and I go, now that I know what they know, I can teach it better than they can. Jeff is like, to me, it would be like if I'm a student of physics and I'm struggling to get through it, he's like the reincarnation of Einstein. I have seen him explain things that are very, very complicated on a blackboard, and I've watched it and I've gone, I understand it completely, and I think he's the only person that could have done that for me. He's here to share that type of teaching with us today. And with that, hey, Jeff, welcome back to the Survival Podcast, man.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Last time we kind of talked about a whole varied bunch of different things. I had a lot of questions from people that after you were on that were relating to things about like looking for land, like what they should look for when they're evaluating a purchase of land. And I had two totally different camps, so I was wondering if you could maybe speak a little bit about like what to look for in both worlds, so to speak. One is from the person that's going to buy in typical suburbia, but they want to try to pick the best property they can, and the other is the person that wants to, say, buy 10, 20 acres and do more of a rural farming type thing. So are there certain things that if you were consulting with somebody on looking for property in those two worlds that you would tell them to try to find or try to avoid?
Oh, yeah. Especially at the moment, because the market's open, and doesn't recognize the value that we do. So you can actually pick up quite a bargain, in a permaculture sense, a bargain. It's not necessarily recognized in the open market. So urban. A funny thing is, if you're going to do an urban institute, which we're encouraging people to do, I often say get the most average house and probably one of the cheapest and sort of one of the worst houses in town, let's say, that's just a sort of average house with an empty backyard, and just make sure you've got good solar aspect. A backyard that's empty or just full of lawn and a sort of rundown average old house is a great one to do up and change over into an energy efficient house and a complete transformation backyard, back garden or garden. So in the suburbs, what you really do have to watch out for is the solar aspect. Are you facing the sun? Are you not too shadowed? The problem is the solution in permaculture, or you've got to be careful because the solution can be the problem as well if you don't design it right. But you can be very wind shadowed in the suburbs, which is great. You can be out of the wind, or you can be in a wind tunnel. You can be in the shade of other buildings, or you can be in a microclimate, and the thermal mass could be an advantage. If you're in a cool climate, or it could be a heat trap if you're in a more subtropical, tropical, or even a desert climate. You've got to think about what makes it comfortable in that climate and what kind of microclimate would make it more comfortable. So in the tropics quite often, or in a desert region, you'd be looking for a shadier garden, really, a shadier position, and you want to use the thermal mass to bank the cold. Where if you're in a cold climate, you're looking the other way round. You're looking to, you want a sun trap and you want to bank the heat. In the urban area, because the square meterage, the square footage, I've got to keep talking in American terms here so we cross both fields of measurement. You don't really have to worry about the soil so much. Because in that small area, you can build soil so fast. And at the moment, where people aren't really valuing organic matter in cities, and there's just this enormous surplus of compostable material that you can almost be paid to remove, which is crazy. You're paid at both ends, really. You get good soil out of what people pay you to take away, almost. You can build soil at a rapid, rapid rate, quicker than anywhere. So soil's not so important. I suppose if you want to move quickly and you're in a, you know, reasonable area, but if you're in an area where you want to help other people, move into an area where people could be helped with a conversion and everybody can take on the same system when they see you're improving your life and everything, you can extend your system out through neighborhoods. A house, you have to be careful if it's hard to change the house around to be more energy efficient. So a house that faces the right way can at least have a conversion of windows so that you get the right sunlight in, or you block the right sunlight out if you're in the tropics or deserts. So those are all crucial things I'd think about in an urban sense. You can also trap quite a lot of water in the suburbs from hard surface runoff. So when the, you know, there's a lot of areas that are just solid material that run off. Now, if you're in an area where there's too much running through your land, that could be difficult to control. If you're right next to a storm drain, often it can be turned into an asset. But you can look at capturing water off roads, off roofs, off driveways, off hard surfaces, to your advantage. And any urban toxicity can be mitigated in large amounts of organic matter included in the soil. Composting systems are wonderful sponges through their carbon interactions as a decomposition process happens. So I often say to people, look, if you're breathing the air in the suburbs, you're probably quite fine to drink water off the roof once you've...
yeah, good point.
I mean, you know, like you're talking about air pollution coming down on roofs. I mean, most of the time, a little bit of limestone in your water tank will take the pH to a level where heavy metals are not water soluble, and they're taken out at the bottom of the tank in anaerobic decomposition. And your soils can be mitigated really quickly with deep mulches and compost. So that's the urban take. I think that's in brief. When you get rural, there's a few things, really. There's a lot of rural land out there that's inappropriate because you don't have good access to water. You've got to look at land where, am I going to get enough water? Are there features in the landscape where I could trap water? Can I impound water? Can I make dams? Have I got access to a creek? Is the groundwater shallow? In other words, not too deep. We're talking about 800 feet or less. If you start tapping into water that's more than 800 feet deep, you probably can never really replenish that with activities on the surface.
Because then we're down into fossil aquifers, right?
Yeah, you're in that fossil aquifer, and you're really into a finite resource again, which is not our game at all. And it never needs to be. We can do everything in those shallower aquifers and swales and leaky dams and gabions and limonia type systems that soak water into the aquifer will replenish that. And over a large area, we could do that very, very, very well and prove it. So access to water is a big thing. And then reasonable soils. If you start going onto landscape that's got really poor soils, the broader area is harder to recover the soil en masse. Your influence over the area is much less. And especially if you want to move in and get going quickly over a broader area, or you want to set up a community system, something like a community land trust, which is the new sort of system taken on from eco-villages. Those sort of systems, there's no point in buying sort of poor access to water and poor soil property. The next one is difficult slopes. If the slopes are too steep or too awkward, or they face the wrong way. The solar aspect is bad. They're too shady. They're too cold, or they're too hot and dry if you're in a desert region. There's, you know, that's just making life difficult for you. So water, soil, angle of slope, those all make a very big difference on your choice. Now, the other thing is if it's covered in forest and it's reasonable regrowth forest, or it's old growth forest, I mean, that would be just a tragedy. We're going to go in and cut down old growth forest to put in a sustainable system. That's not what we're about.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because as I've been looking for land myself, I mean, that's one of the things I'm running into. I find land at, you know, 20 acres and it's heavily wooded, and I just go, I'd prefer that to stay the way that it is. Or the 5 acres I have now, it's 25-year-old regrowth forest, and it's steep slope and it's rocky, and it would just seem like I would be doing more harm than good.
Yeah, I mean, some of those properties can be set up as nice retreats, and you can put a tiny garden in, or a small garden, and you can get away by yourself. But if you want a bit more area to work, we shouldn't be taking down reasonable quality forest. You have to draw a line sometimes. In the subtropics, where I live, which is a climate similar to parts of Florida, I'll take down 20-year-old low-quality regrowth forest. So it's 20 years old, it's not high quality forest, and it's not moving through to a very high quality rainforest type species assembly. It's just an average sort of reasonably low quality regrowth. I'd take that down to put in water systems, especially dams, because I'll see the exchange of environment as an improvement. So shallow water, shallow lakes and ponds, faster soil builders than forest, and an exchange here of about 20 years of low quality forest to water systems, I'll make that move. But after that, I'm very much questioning whether I take it down. The other thing is that, you know, unless you actually want to, your main mission is to improve forest and become a farm forestry, mainly a farm forestry system, you're putting yourself in the shade, you're making it awkward. There might even be local trees that are somewhat allopathic and don't easily, you know, not much grows underneath them well. So you're just making it awkward for yourself. So a lot of the alternative movement in the early sort of days, in the last 20, 30 years, they moved on to the early community lands with this dream, which is not a bad dream, but they bought land that was poor access to water, low quality soil, difficult slopes, covered in forest, then moved in and tried to, you know, be sustainable in the shade in a very awkward situation. And it's understandable that they didn't work. There was quite a few type one errors. And then they went into strange decision-making processes, which sort of threw out all the traditions that we've had for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years almost, and tried to create a new paradigm of human settlement. Very difficult, but now there are more successful communities popping up because of our ability to help with design and property choice. Very important, and we can save people a lot of time and heartache by helping them look for land. In fact, it's actually quite a good business as a permaculture consultant designer to go out and look for land that's worth developing and just put in the mainframe developments. And we've done a little bit of that. Look for properties that have good dam sites, good slopes, good soil and water, and put in the dams, the swales, the house sites, because people often don't know where to position themselves in the landscape.
So you mean by mainframe, like the major earthworks and the initial stuff that you do, the hardscaping, so to speak, and then let somebody else design it up from there?
Yeah, give them the pleasure of putting the filling out the flesh on the bones of your mainframe design. So the mantra of a lot of design consultants in permaculture goes in this order: water, access, structural positions. So you go in, because water is so important and it's got so many constants about the way it behaves. Get those water points and contour lines well defined and installed. harmonize your access around the water points and contour lines and positions. So access harmonizing with water pattern, and we know access is much easier to maintain because it's very expensive to install and can be expensive to maintain if you don't get it right. Keep your access on contour or down the middle of, or as close to contour as possible, and then second choice, down the middle of ridge lines, so the water shed off access ways is shed. And then position your structures in really a multifunctional position. So your house site needs to be sort of mid slopes. It definitely needs to be below water sources, so you've got gravity fed water. So we would go in and we would find properties with really good dam sites that you can easily build at a low cost and get good storage of water, then put in our swell soakages and set up the gravity irrigation systems, put in the main driveway and the track accesses around the property, develop the property with the major tree plantings on swales, all on gravity drip irrigations, get the property up in a bit of respectable looking maintenance, so tractor slashing the grass and getting it tidied up a bit. And then nice house site, and the very last thing we do is a very good quality driveway finished off very nicely graveled and rolled in, and then sell it on with the profit put on the developed earthworks a bit. So it leaves the client who buys in saying, oh, that I can still, you know, put in my house that I've fantasized about in a really good position, maybe looking at a feature dam with really good gravity irrigation, and I'm set to go. I can live the dream from there. And a lot of people don't put enough thought into those very basic mainframe designs.
Well, yeah, because everybody designs everything in a square, and they think in that geometrically boring way. And what you're describing reminds me of, like, remember the old paint-by-numbers stuff where it would say, like, put blue in, you know, in all the ones that say 9? And it's almost like you're giving the person the paint-by-numbers, but they pick their own colors.
That's it. I mean, you can – a lot of people come in and they start fantasizing about the finer details, which is fine if you've got the main frame right.
Yeah.
They don't put enough time and thought into those very, very big mainframe positionings because that sets the foundation of everything that happens from then on. And one of the classics here in Australia, and I expect it's the same in a lot of places, people often build on the top of the hill for a view.
Sure.
And they're above all their potential water sources. And you're going to be running pumps and maintenance on infrastructure forever from then on. And if the power goes off, you're probably going to be carrying water.
Which or you're going to have a lot of stuff die before you get it irrigated.
Yeah. Where if it's, you know, if it's, you can set properties up to be drought-proofed and automatic irrigation with nothing but gravity-fed water systems. So it's a pleasure to see what happens when you get it right and people end up in a very stable lifestyle and often in a very stable family situation where their family is one that goes on as a very stable family that inherits the property and continues generation after generation developing a really good system. And eventually, if enough people do that, we develop really good community, of course.
Yeah. Here's the thing that keeps coming up, and it's because of you, by the way. You're the primary one. There's some other work that's been done out there that's caused us to swell, but you're the one I hear in the email all the time that they've watched, Greening the Desert. And Greening the Desert, the sequel. And then these folks go out and they look on eBay here and they see that they can buy land like in West Texas or New Mexico where there's very low rainfall. I would say the environments are, to be fair, not as harsh as some of the things that you did in Jordan. But they watch your video and they think, well, I'll go buy this piece of wasteland in West Texas and I'll do it up with some swales and things the way that Jeff did. And I'll green the desert myself. And I think that's a noble ideal, but could you maybe tell people, what are you really getting into when you do something like that?
Yeah. Well, you're getting into an environment that if you get a result, it really stands out.
Okay.
So, it's a, you know, if you get it right in those harsh environments, then it becomes extremely obvious that you've got quite a result. you're in a situation where water is everything and every drop counts. So your water positions and your water harvesting is crucial. So it's kind of ironic that you're in a situation where there doesn't really appear to be very much water, and yet you're designing mainly to capture it when it arrives. A lot of people don't realize that water in the dry and desert regions arrives in very large amounts and very infrequently. So as the classic author of The Secret Knowledge of Water, David Childs, puts it, a desert is a flood waiting to happen. So that's one of the big ironic situations in deserts, and you have to design for a flood that's about to happen. And that seems really daft, because we've relied on pumps and infrastructure that supplies with water from underground and all those sort of systems, and we've forgotten about these traditional systems and the new application of design around that. So you're waiting for that flood, and then you need to design so that anti-evaporation is your main theme. The reason you're in a dry land, a desert, is a landscape where the evaporation is much higher than the rainfall. So marginal deserts are a 50-50. 50% of the time the rainfall is over the evaporation. There's more rainfall than evaporation. And half of the year the rainfall is less than the evaporation. The evaporation is much higher. Now, if those areas are deforested, if the forest is removed, if the tree cover is removed from those marginal areas, they become the extension of desert. Now, the reason for that is the condensation that drips off the trees, which is very rarely counted, can equal 80% of the rainfall. So that adds a volume of up to 80% of water hitting the soil over rainfall. Now, it's the condensation drip off the trees. Now, if you take that condensating area away by deforesting, and these brittle landscapes can be easily deforested and the deforestation can be perpetuated by overgrazing or burning and overgrazing. They're easily burnt, they're easily overgrazed, they're easily damaged. Then you greatly increase the effect of evaporation, and you diminish the overall precipitation because you've lost the condensating figure. So at any cost, and I mean any cost, you have to cover the soil. You have to get in there somehow and wait for rain. If you've got no irrigation of any sort, maybe you can pump from underground in the shallow aquifers or whatever. And you wait for rain with your water capturing, water soaking systems. And when it comes, you plant the hardiest of species. Because it doesn't matter what it is, really. You just want shade and a condensating surface, because the hot winds will cause evaporation. So you've got to get some windbreaks up, and those are hardy trees. The full sun will increase evaporation, so you've got to get shade. And you'll get the condensation on top, and then over time you'll get organic matter from those hardy elements. If possible, bring some in and get some organic matter going, because the more organic matter on the soil and in the soil, the more retention of moisture, and you want to retain every bit of moisture. So anti-evaporation first at all costs. Then you can start to get up and out. You're getting into the shade, you're getting into the cool, you're getting out of the hot winds, you're increasing organic matter. And it's really permaculture 101 with full faith and belief in what you're doing. Mm. And you really can't compromise on that. You must. So it's a great area to work if you've got commitment and passion, because very quickly it responds. Dry areas often have a lot of residual fertility. because nothing. If you're in an,
there's a lot of mineral fertility there, definitely, right?
Yeah, and a lot of organic matter just hangs about. If the donkey dies in a harsh desert, it's there for 4 years later, sort of withering away as a skin and bone. Mm. If the donkey dies in the subtropics or tropics, it's gone in a week.
Yep.
It just rots away. I mean, everything just decomposes in high humidity. But in those dry landscapes, there's a lot of organic matter sitting around, and quite a lot is blown in the wind. So your trees not only are a wind buffer to evaporation, they're also a airborne nutrient catch. They're catching minerals and organic matters in those dusts and winds. So you once you start moving forward in the positive, doesn't matter what landscape you're in, you're on a positive track, and on you go, and then the refinements come in. So that's mainframe deserts for you in brief. Your refinements come in later, and then you can start playing. You can't play with any of this stuff to start with. You're on a rule game. You've got to do it right.
There's a question I'd like to ask you on this. When I look at the desert regions of the world, I see these areas that, like you've talked about, has expanded into. So, like, another fascinating story for me is Yacouba Sagadoa in the Sahel region of Africa with Zai farming and bring the forest back in the sub-Saharan region. So, like, in that region, if we could somehow get a time machine and we could go back in time 400 years and go to that area that he's working in, it would be a sub-desert, but it would be a forested sub-desert. If we go north into the Sahara, to the dead center of it, even 1,000 years ago, it pretty much would look the way that it does. So when we're looking to rehabilitate these lands, do you think we should be looking more to places where it's been expanded by human activity than the place where it's basically, that's just is what it is?
I think human activity can be reversed, and as negative as we presently are, we could be equally positive. And I have no doubt whatsoever about that. So whatever we're doing now in the negative sense, if you turn that round and made it the reverse positive, we could do that, and not only do that, we could increase that function. So we could probably reforest every desert on the planet.
Do you think we could reforest the deserts that were deserts before we screwed it up is what I'm asking, right? So, again, there's these places, like I could take you to places in Arizona, that if we could go back 250 years – they were forested deserts. They were green deserts, right? But then the war effort and cotton growth and all, and Bill did some work on this with Global Gardener in the 80s and showed these swales that were out there. They expanded the true desert. And that's one thing. But do you think we could go into these places that, you know, before we even screwed it up, it was already just sand? Could those areas be greened, or do we need to focus on what we screwed up before we try to fix what was always that way, I guess, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think we could. The only point in doing it would be a showcase at this stage. There's enough of the marginal area we can move in towards those areas. And I think over a reasonable length of time, we can change climate and moderate those areas and creep into them. And when we could do it for a showcase, I don't think we've got time for showcases at the moment, really. But those marginal areas... if you look at the work of John Lewis in China and the Laos Plateau, where they reforested, you know, 35,000 square kilometers, the size of Belgium, over 10 years, and they did it with just $500 million.
Yep.
It's incredibly cheap what they achieved there in the Laos Plateau, and I'm working with John Lewis. Made that famous film, Hope in a Changing Climate. Incredible showcase work.
It's funny you say that. I just saw that for the first time last week. A listener sent it to me. They start out in China, and then they go to Africa, and they show how they've basically done the same thing in two places in different ways, and they've had the same results. It's absolutely amazing what they did in China and Ethiopia.
Yeah, Ethiopia and Rwanda. Now, Rwanda's taken on the system right across the landscape. John's working with us on broad landscape rehabilitation institutes, permaculture institutes at the center of all his work. 10,000 square kilometers in Oman is coming online. They've seen that, you know, it's our duty to repair the broad damaged ecosystems of the planet. We've proved we can do it. Now, the water starts to flow. The water is trapped in the vegetation. In the film, Hope in a Changing Climate, you see the water flowing in the valley in Ethiopia after about just 8 years. That's all it took. Now, if you're in a landscape, just a trick for people, if they're in a deserted landscape and you look up at the hills and they're rounded, they're not angular, you're in a landscape that was definitely quite well forested. And a lot of the Middle East is like that. You look up around the hills in Amman, even around Jerusalem, and you see rounded hills in a deserted landscape. That means that it was that marginal landscape that was part of the year evaporation over rainfall, part of the year rainfall over evaporation, and water has shaped those rounded hills over millennia. That area can definitely be easily reforested. And as we then move in, we can revegetate. The term forest brings up visions of giant forests. But let's say we can very much stabilize and revegetate the area.
West Texas forest. The trees are, 15 feet high, and there's a lot of scrub and everything. But it's green and it's stable.
That's it. Yeah, then we can do all that. I mean, I don't think that's difficult very much at all. I think we should be a lot more positive about those situations, especially with the present technology and equipment we have. It just has to be applied into really good design. Another system that you need to look at, and it's fascinating, is the work of Tony Rinaldo, who works for World Vision. Because of the Google Earth images and the satellite images we now have dating back over 20 years, he was picked up in Niger in Africa, and through satellite imagery, they said, what the hell is going on in Niger? It's turning green while the rest of Africa gets more brown every year.
Wow.
And they went on down into Niger, and there's Tony. And he's been in there slogging away for 20 years. He's a student of mine from PDC. And working with a $2 pocket knife. And they said, well, this is incredible. I mean, people can't fix the desert with $20 billion. He's got a $2 pocket knife, and he's showing people how to manage the grazed trees that regrow as a multi-stemmed coppiced bush. And if you cut them to the strongest leader and maintain the regrowth as just one leader, they turn back into a tree in 3 years.
Oh, wow.
Very quickly, because the root system's so deep, and they prove their genetics, they're living proof of their genetic strength, because they handle mostly goats and animal grazing every year. Now, he literally single-handedly and doggedly worked with people to give them ownership on those trees and got them up. Reforested and put 500,000 tons of grain production on the country. And he calls the system FMNR, Farmer Managed Natural Regen. He's now working all over the world with that system. An incredibly simplistic system with very low budget. And everywhere I work since I got introduced to Tony's work, I've looked at the same events everywhere. Everywhere you go across deserts, you don't see the animals very often because they're only there now and again. When there's a flush of moisture, there's a bit of flush of vegetation, they'll run animals across and they're gone again. You have to be there to see the event. But what they're doing is they're grazing off the regrowth trees almost like a copper stump. And it just looks like a dead tree most of the year, and it rains and it flushes vegetation. It throws up a few moldy stems. Little surviving tree out there with some kind of surviving root system gets grazed off again. Tony stopped all that. He got people, look, just let me test this with you. You stop the grazing in an area for a while. Let's cut all the regrowth stems off the trees, except for one, the strongest one, and let's see what happens. And bang, up they go into a tree real fast. And then you've got shade. Then you've got less evaporation from wind. You've got some organic matter. The little stems they cut off, they use for firewood. He gave them, like, the ideas of rocket stoves that they can cook in with a little bit, stick fuel. And it just started to go viral. It went
so on the livestock, then, are they taking the fodder to the goats instead of the goats to the fodder so that they're not damaging the land?
That's it.
Okay.
And this literally is a little sharp blade that don't have to have a pair of secateurs or anything. You can do it just with a little $2 pocket knife. What a system. I mean, it's just the man needs a Nobel Prize for that one, I reckon.
And his last name, is it Ronaldo?
Ronaldo, yeah. If you just look up FMNR on our website or just Google it, and he'll come up.
Okay, great. And I'll make sure I put some links to his stuff in the show notes, because that's absolutely fascinating, Jeff.
Yeah, when he hasn't put in the earthworks or anything else. He just did one. It's often something so simple. Too simple.
It's almost like nature knows what she's doing if we'll let her.
Sorry?
It's almost like nature knows what she's doing if we'll let her.
Yeah, I mean, it's what we often do when we plant trees is we haven't got the ability to grow good enough trees in nurseries that then survive the first year of planting. So it's such a shame that well-intended tree plantings are often not very successful. So in a lot of damaged ecosystems, it's an alarming figure of about 11 trees in 1,000 that survive, that are planted. We should be paid for trees that grow, not trees that are planted.
Is there ways we can do a better job of that? I mean, is there certain practices that need to be implemented with tree propagation?
There are some very unusual nursery systems that are more successful. They're not so common and not often adopted. But the thing that Tony came up with was these trees are survivors, proven by the fact that they still exist after so much grazing. So they're guaranteed genetic survivors, guaranteed genetically strong. We have some unusual nursery systems in Australia that are extending a little bit. They're rather unconventional, with pots with air holes in the side. So you've got sort of instead of your conventional nursery pot, you've got a tree planting pot. There's peppered with holes all the way around the sides, and the trees grow lateral roots much, much stronger. And then when they hit holes in the side of the pot, they air prune, and they form very strong root systems of trees, and they grow three times the speed of normal potted trees, because they're often growing in a sort of root ball that needs to be, needs to untangle itself before it starts to grow in the soil.
Sure.
Those same systems have also been flood irrigated. So people are now often starting to use these shallow tanks, where what you do is these same pots that have got holes peppered all around the side, instead of watering from above with a sprinkler, you actually fill a shallow tank. So they're flood irrigated from underneath, and then once the pots are completely saturated with water, so there's no damp and wet and dry spots in the pot, it's completely saturated because it's literally gone under water for a few minutes. Then the water's drained, and what they do is they weigh the tree in the pot when it's saturated, after the water's drained, but it's saturated with water, and then they don't irrigate again until it's 2/3 the weight.
I got you.
I keep weighing the trees to see when they need water again in relation to the weight.
It's kind of like flush and drain aquaponics then.
Yeah, well, I've actually thought about whether we could actually do that and link it to growing systems like aquaponics or something similar. What is very handy with that system too for deserts, for your desert listeners, is you can recycle that water through the nursery continuously. You're losing very little water.
Sure, yeah.
Most of the water is actually going to tree growth, and it's not wasted on past the nursery or soaked on somewhere else. So if you're very limited on water, those soak systems are great, and Trentcom is the name of the company that developed it here in Australia, and they're called Rocket Pots and Rocket Racks, a very clever little invention. And I've seen the results of those trees, and you start putting those out on swales where trees grow three times the speed they do anywhere else anyway, and you've really got a fast system.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, absolutely. So there's a product I want. Maybe you haven't seen it. Maybe you have. Maybe you looked at it or tried it. Or you might be just like, I don't know, and I can't tell you. There's a product called Growasis that is by a guy out of either the UK or right in like the London area, or might be from Ireland. I'm not sure. But basically, it's this round thing that has a water reservoir in it and a little dripper, and it creates a microclimate, and it gives the tree less water than it really needs. So it makes this kind of funnel shape, and it drives the taproot down. And his whole point is to regreen the deserts. Have you seen that at all?
Yeah. It's a little evaporative. It creates a little bit of condensation inside it as well.
Correct. Yeah, you put a few liters of water in there to get it started, and it catches, if it does rain, it catches that. It catches condensation. Have you guys actually played with those things at all? Yeah, we were thinking about getting some and just, you know, trying them out. But it seems like it makes perfect sense anyway from a theoretical standpoint.
Yep. John Louis and I have both looked at those, and they do seem to work. You do still need to choose the right tree, and you still need to plant it in the right place. It's not obviously design itself. It's a little tool. The problem is we're talking about billions of trees. Although one of the systems were that you could reuse it on other trees after it's got a tree established, or another process was to make them biodegradable, so it sort of rots down after a period of time as mulch. So maybe it's, you know, then it's cheaper as an element to start with. And we see some results with those, but the numbers game is the problem.
Sure.
You really are talking about a lot of trees. I mean, I tell my students, don't plant trees. Planting trees is a waste of time. Don't bother planting trees. You're joking. Plant ecosystems.
Got you.
You've got to plant an ecosystem. A tree by itself is damn useless. It can't support itself on its own, very rarely. It's a pretty unusually genetic special if it does that. And that's one of those Tony Rinaldo choices. You've checked it out with goats grazing it off for many years. I mean, you don't know how to do that. We don't know how to select those genetics very easily. But you've got to plant an ecosystem, a self-supported ecosystem, which is a whole layered set of assembly and support species. And then you can move in. You can have your major climax species or productive species or major functional species central to an ecosystem type planet. So you've got to think. We've got to think ecosystems. That's a lot of those little pots. And that's a... You know, even in a small area, people are shocked at how densely I plant trees. I've got a bit of a reputation of overstacking, but I'd rather overstack than understack every single time.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I mean, I do that with even cover cropping when I'm throwing down like legumes, like red cowpea or whatever. It's easy to take some out, but once they're going, it's hard to put more in.
Yeah, you've just lost time.
Correct.
You can stack extra time into a system and still come out in front. But if you don't stack enough time into a system, you come out behind. So you're in a spatial race with the weeds. And you've got to disfavor what you don't want. You don't have to kill it. You just have to disfavor it so that you win the race. And the race is to a beneficial ecosystem establishment, whatever that might be. Whatever you want the end result to be, whatever the productivity or function or establishment is, the climax, you've got to win the race, especially at the beginning of the race. You've got to really disadvantage what you don't want at the start line.
Got you. So if we can shift gears to like another problem, because I think this is a problem most Americans aren't even aware of, and you seem to have a pretty big insight to it. And it's not a place without a lot of water. It's a place with tons of water. And it's our whole Mississippi River Delta. And I don't think most Americans, many who live right around that area, and they look and they see all this green and all this lush, realize that there's actually a real problem there. And not only is there a problem there, there's a permaculture solution to it. And I know that you're very aware of this because you've talked about it in the one PDC that I saw you do. Could you kind of explain that problem and what its solution really is?
Yeah, well, that's a great one. What a wonderful river.
It is. Parts of it don't go where it used to go, but it is a great river system.
I worked in northwest Louisiana for quite a few years going back and forwards, and I was actually working on a Louisiana Army ammunition manufacturing plant redesign near Minden, close to Bossier City, Shreveport, Bossier City area. And then I ended up working in Lafayette and New Orleans with the Cypress Academy and Tulane University. So I ended up with quite an understanding of the Cypress swamps and thinking in the larger scale as we do in permaculture, looking at whole systems, the complete basin and catchment of the Mississippi, which is a major part of America. And you have the Army Corps of Engineers, who used to write our paychecks out of Rock Island, Illinois, for that job. We were able to communicate with the Army Corps of Engineers, and they've done a lot of the civil engineering work on the levee banks and the barrage dams up the Mississippi. And what we've done is we've kind of controlled the river to do what we want it to do, rather than what it could possibly do. And you've got an order two river there. So it's in the largest rivers of the world, except the Amazon, which is in a class of its own as an Order 1 river. So this is a major Order 2 river, and what an incredible river. It pulls so much catchment out of North America. It just about starts in Canada. And the bottom lands there, the Atchafalaya Swamp, is such a glorious system. And all of those major settlements down in the bottomlands near New Orleans, they're up on great big deposition banks where the river is up higher than the floodplain, like most of the classic rivers of the world. And they've been formed by the deposition of millions of years of floods. And that area at the bottom of the Mississippi there has a geological tilt that's going down slightly. So, and that was compensated by the deposition of all the silts and nutrients that used to fall out with the giant floods, which now don't really happen so much. So directing water downstream towards the Gulf of Mexico, and that's taken with it a lot of nutrient and a lot of other additives that are put onto the agricultural soils and landscapes of America, and that's causing that hypoxia zone, that dead zone in the Gulf, which could be completely reversed. It could be turned into a life rich, the absolute opposite, a life rich zone, a nutrient rich, beneficial outfall of America. And that was my dream. That was thinking big. That's the ultimate contract in America, to reverse the effects of the Mississippi down there. And repattern the landscape so that it became a biological filter rather than a nutrient and toxicity drain. What we've done is we've taken a basic principle and reversed it, and that is the principle of the fertility of water. So water should take the longest path over the most distance, over the most time, moving as slowly as possible, with as much passive friction as possible, rubbing up against as many living things or beneficial elements along the way. That's the principle of water in landscape for myself, and I think if most permaculture designers thought about it, they would agree that's what they're actually doing. They're putting water to work. Water has duties to perform for us in the landscape. And if we design it well, then water becomes our major asset. And its first duty is to create life. Its second duty is to create productivity within itself in the form of aquaculture. And its third duty, and it is the third duty, is to harvest energy through mechanical elements like paddle wheels and turbines and electric generation and things like that. But first life, then aquaculture, and then energy in that order. And if we repattern our catchment by catchment, and if anybody's listening who wants to take on a top catchment of, like, one of the top catchments, one of the side branches of the Mississippi, and start at the top and come down a section, we can actually prove this. And John Louis's work proves it. You can see it in that Hope in a Changing Climate, that small catchment they did in Rwanda. If you can do that catchment by catchment in the Mississippi, or like all the major river systems of the world, that'll do it. That'll set the world-changing example of where we need to go. And the wealth of America continues in a biological sense, which is always going to be the largest wealth we'll ever create, the living wealth.
See, and I think there'd be a huge financial payoff there too as well, because just the impact on the fisheries in the Gulf, without having that dead zone that's always there and the giant one that's there in the middle of summer, if that were gone, the impact on the fishery industry alone would probably pay for the reconstruction of from the Delta up to the Canadian border.
Unimaginable. An unimaginable amount of wealth. And just to put it in some American terminology, what are you creating? You're creating future oil in the biological rot of those elements, aren't you? I mean, that's what you're actually doing. And at the moment, you're not going to have any oil in the millennia of the future because you're removing all the biological deposits that create the damn stuff, you know? it sends the imagination off on incredible time zones thinking about this, but there's nothing wrong with that. It's such an encapsulated catchment there. The Mississippi is such a large part of North America and the major element of wealth in the original biology. A key point in redesigning it all. And we could subsidize it catchment by catchment, economy by economy, as we regenerate. And I mean, people are very quick to take initiative, subsidized or not. Once you see everybody doing better somewhere nearby, you just go and do it, don't you? And you just copy on.
Absolutely, yeah. Peer pressure in a positive way, right?
Yeah.
So kind of switching gears again as we get toward wrapping up here, one of my hot-button issues, one of the biggest things that I just have, like, a passionate hatred of, and I remember watching Bill one time saying, follow your anger, it'll lead you faster than what you love, what I see companies like Monsanto and Bayer, et cetera, ConAgra, dealing with genetically modified organisms, and I don't just hate the fact that they're doing it, I hate what they're modifying it to do. So I take something like soy and I modify it so I can spray it with glyphosate, so that I can spray glyphosate three times a year on the same field I used to spray it on once. How big a danger do you think that whole sector represents?
Oh, well, first off, I'd like to start. I would say the problem could be the solution here. I'd love to have their research budget.
Sure.
And if we just turned it around, we could see that, you know, biological speciation, the encouragement of biological speciation is a completely different game. If we're looking at diversity rather than simplicity, if we change that research budget into creating a new species every 6 minutes through speciation, which I think we could do, because speciation is something completely different. But genetic modification in a laboratory for specific results, and it can be used as a weapon here because it could be infertility genes that you're splicing into corn or any of those kind of weird things. You're playing Russian roulette with the gene pool, and you never know when it's going to come back and bite you or that bullet comes around in the chamber. And we've nearly done it a couple of times. The genetic modification of the clad seed in bacteria that sits on all green material leaves, on all leaves, Pseudomonas syringae, that happened in the 1970s. So, and there was scientific uproar. I mean, nobody knew about GMOs back then much. It wasn't public knowledge, but we genetically engineered a bacteria that sits on the leaf surface area of most plants, almost all plants and trees, and when it blows off to the atmosphere, it captures ice nuclei because it's just classically formed like a little spiky element, a spiky bacteria, and that's what makes most of the rain inland from the oceans. Once you get past a few mountain ranges or a couple of rains, three or four rains back on the coast, Now, potentially,
is that what Bill Mollison put out back in the 80s that they finally confirmed, like, you know, 10 years ago, that you could tell the where rain came from by the density of the molecules of the water, you know, whether it was ocean generated or tree generated? Is that what you're talking about?
That's it. Pseudomonas syringae. Pseudomonas is the genus, syringae is the species, and it was genetically engineered to have bumps on it to stop frost damage on strawberries.
Ugh.
So we were going to get a lot of strawberries, but we could have lost 20 to 50% of the world's rain if it started to crossbreed through the other Pseudomonas. So that was potentially a sociopathic scientific behavior, potentially. And then the event that sparked Elaine Ingham's soil food web extension was the genetically modified soil organism that could be introduced to crop waste that created a byproduct of alcohol, which could have been used as another product or a fuel. Nobody soil tested that in a laboratory with plants. They just tested it in soil, but not with plants. And alcohol in the soil is a complete plant poison. So when she tested it, she got permission to test it, all plants died. So and that was very close to being released. It was only a few days away before her protest stopped that. Now,
so that literally would have been like a plant plague globally.
Well, that could have been like the blob. I mean, it would have just... What are you going to do, nuke it? I mean, it could be... You can't whistle these things back in. They're microorganisms, and their life cycles are fast. So out it went. And if that had blown up in the air and gone aerosol, it would have been like patches of dead zones coming up across the planet. That's horrific.
Oh.
I don't know how you stop that. And then you're going to see desertification, all right. And global economy, we'll just forget it. I mean, it's just going to have no relevance whatsoever. We've got to realize that the real global economy is in extending life systems and not depleting life systems, and we know we can do it. We know we can increase life systems worldwide. Why don't we do that? It's not that expensive. It was nowhere near as expensive as the loss we're going into continuously now as we spiral down in the economy. We should reverse those budgets. I mean, it's pretty simple. It's got to be life-enhancing, soil-creating. We've got to increase diversity, increase organic matter. You know, living systems have to be enriching all the time, not depleting all the time. And if we set a few standards like that, I mean, organic agriculture is just not good enough. It can still be soil depleting, water depleting, you know, people exploiting. And just because it's organic, we tend to think, oh, well, it's all cool. Well, it's not. And some of the worst exploited agriculture I've seen recently is organic.
Yeah, I mean, I tell people all the time, destroying angel mushroom is organic, but if you eat one, you're dead. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, just because it's organic doesn't mean it's good. What do you call it? A castor bean is organic, but can make sarin gas out of it.
Yeah. I've seen in California 40 tons of carrots produced on an acre over, you know, that's the average across 700 acres of monoculture carrots, where, you know, Mexican workers are almost enslaved to weed and farm these carrots, and there's a giant diesel pump running 24/7, sucking the aquifer down to a big storage dam, and another diesel pump running 24/7, running traveling irrigators, and you know 10,000 trucks of organic compost brought in every year to dump down on these carrots, and the aquifer's going down, the soil's becoming more saline, the immigrant workers are underpaid, and yet you've got trendy organic carrots. In a valley where 10,000 native people used to live and steelhead salmon used to run upstream in a river that's now dry and dead. That's not, that's organic, but it's not sustainable. It's got a very short lifetime. It's economic. It makes money. But that doesn't make it sustainable. So that's the wrong economy. That's not the economy we're talking about. We're talking a completely different economy.
You know, when you talk about economy, I just think that if we could get corporations and businesses to just think in a not even a huge time horizon, just a little bit longer time horizon, a 10 to 15 year planning cycle versus a quarterly planning cycle, that what we are advocating doing actually is far more profitable, even from a pure economic standpoint. You just have to give it time to kind of, it's like almost like a system reboot. Like, okay, you've screwed it up. Now you have to do a restart.
Oh, yeah, and the popularity would be incredible. I'd give it 3 to 5. Okay. I'd give it 3 to 5 years.
And that's not that big of a time horizon, but everything in America, everything in the civilized world that's on a public stock exchange is measured on a quarterly basis, 4 times a year. No one's looking out to the 5th year, which is actually very ironic, because when you invest in a stock, you're paying today, hopefully paying less today than it will be worth, 5 years from now. That's the whole point. But that's not how investors think, and that's part of it. Probably an educational paradigm that's too deep to get into today.
Yeah, I mean, I think with our project work, we find after 3 years, if things go well and we've got some reasonable funding, in 3 years, it's pretty damn obvious you're on a winner, and in 5 years, you know you're on a winner. No question. So at 3 years, you look at it and think, wow, this is really, something's really happening here. This is really worth keeping going on. This is worth keeping. At the 5 years, you go, we know. It's done. It's a done deal at 5 years. It's just a matter of sitting there and watching the interest come in.
Yeah, and I just watched a video you put out of what 10 years on the PRI there did. And it was pretty amazing. So I'll make sure I put a video of that in the show notes so people can see what you guys did in 10 years, which – in the time frame of even a human lifetime isn't that long, but for human history, it's nothing.
Yeah, well, we were with no funding. We camped on this site originally, and we taught 6,000 odd students in that time, and they got in the way of us developing the land, because we spent a lot of time on irrigation and on education, and a lot of time on helping people make mistakes here, on turning our site over to a lot of people so they can practice on it. And half that time I've been working overseas on aid projects as well. So,
it's really not 10 years in reality.
There was 3 years from 2003 to 2006 where I never touched the site. I went overseas and went from aid project to aid project. And literally, it was a little bit more than 3 years we were actually off the site. So it's 7 years of being here, but most of that time has been consumed in education. And everybody is coming now more and more informed with the internet, but less and less physically capable of doing anything because they spend so much time on the internet. They're less and less skilled and therefore more and more concerned. They've got access to information, good and bad, but they've got less and less physical skill because they need to reskill and they don't know how to, and very few people are providing that. And so people are more and more concerned, and we're dealing with people's concern, to get them sort of functional and positive. So education centers are a major thing. Education centers and demonstration sites are what we concentrate on. We just need, as many as we can. And there's no shortage of clients. We're in a boom industry.
Well, and I think the other thing is, like, that more and more people need to understand, like, do what you can with what you have. So, like, go get some experience. Even if it's in your little small, 20th of an acre backyard, go do something, because as much concern as you have, action is the way to address the concern. And then I think you've said this many times. A lot of times people think, like, I don't have enough space, I don't have enough area. But the more restrictions you place on yourself when you start actually applying the knowledge, the more elegant the design becomes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the small areas of diverse perennial plantings are incredible, and it's such therapy. You go into a new learning curve, an experiential curve, so you get an academic memory sort of boost and a muscle memory boost as well. So you're getting physical and mental health, and you move into a sort of positive mode of action, and then I think we start to function well.
Yeah, I agree completely, and I think we've kind of wrapped up an hour here, a little bit over, but you want to remind people how they can, if they want to help out the work you guys are doing there at the PRI in Australia, and contribute and chip in a little bit, how they can do that?
Yeah, you can contact us and see our website on permaculture.org.au and have a look at our worldwide projects there onto the permacultureglobal.com. So those two websites are open and running, and you can see the depth and breadth of permaculture and all the work we're helping people with. We have a permaculture master plan for people who want to set up demonstration sites and education centers and a contract of how we help you get going. So all of that's on our website, permaculture.org.au. And thanks for the opportunity, Jeff.
Oh, thanks for being here, Jeff. This is a absolute wide open invitation. Anytime you want to come back and speak to our audience and our community, you are more than welcome. It's really a big honor to have you on the show. You're one of without ever meeting me, you've taught me more than you'll probably ever know, and you've been one of my true mentors. So thanks for being here with us.
Pleasure. We'll do it again, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. And folks, with that, this has been Jack Spirico today with Jeff Lawton, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough. Or even if they don't.
It's in our food these days, you know, it's on our TVs. Sometimes we forget that we are what we eat. I don't know the answer, it's like there's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live in an eternity. Make your own. Revolution. Someday we'll realize our children just can't pay. Nobody up there cares, they're living for today. Revolution is you.